For 7 decades, the Kim family has ruled North Korea, beginning with Kim Il-sung in the 1930s, then his son, Kim Jong-il, and his son, the current dictator, Kim Jong-un. All three leaders exercise total control over the 25 million citizens of North Korea, and that same control extends to the image that they've crafted to the outside world. We know almost nothing about them, and even as Kim Jong-un garners world headlines, he remains relatively sealed off from scrutiny. So, who is he? How has he held on to power when other dictators have been toppled? And will he manage to keep doing that? Anna Fifield is a longtime observer of North Korea. She's the Beijing bureau chief for The Washington Post. And her new book, The Great Successor, The Divinely Perfect Destiny of Brilliant Comrade Kim Jong-un, offers a rare window into the supreme leader's highly secretive world. It's also highly readable, I've got to tell you, full of unexpected details. Occasionally, it is darkly funny, but not too much stress on the funny bit. I'm delighted that Anna could find some time to join us for her first Australian interview about the book. Anna Fifield, welcome to Saturday Extra.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
And love the title, The Divinely Perfect Destiny of Brilliant Comrade Kim.
Yeah, well, I mean, brilliant comrade, great successor. These are all North Korea's words for Kim Jong-un. But of course, I've used them to show just how ridiculous this kind of whole myth and the propaganda surrounding him is.
I think something that's worth noting is that it's almost impossible to get any access to Kim. There is so much propaganda built up around him within North Korea. How do you go about trying to write a biography of someone like that?
Yeah, with great difficulty, actually. And in fact, I don't say that it's a biography because I think that we cannot get the kind of access that you would have to write a real biography of anyone. But what I set out to do was to write the story of who he is, you know, how he became the leader of North Korea, and also how he has defied all the expectations to remain there.
We do seem to be having a
and
little
so bit. I did that, you know, of course.
We do seem to be having a little bit of difficulty with that line. I think we'll persist. You've identified quite a lot of remarkable detail about his childhood, the way he grew up, what he was like as a young man.
Yes, that's right. I set out to try to find all of the people who had ever met him, and particularly who knew him when he was a child. So, for example, I met the Japanese sushi chef who lived in the North Korean royal court household while Kim Jong-un was from the age of 6 and 7 or so. And he used to take Kim Jong-un fishing with him, used to fly kites with him. He, you know, spent a lot of time with him while Kim Jong-un was a child because he had no friends. You know, Kim Jong-un didn't go to school. He had tutors who would come into the palace there with him. And I also tracked down Kim Jong-un's aunt and uncle. They are people who posed as his parents and looked after him while he was in Switzerland. Then they defected from Switzerland more than 20 years ago. But they were able to tell me a bit about what he was like as a teenager.
I think one of the really interesting things that you've explored in this book is the notion of what expectation existed about him being educated in Switzerland versus what, in reality, the impact was. There was a hope, wasn't there, that by being educated in Switzerland, Kim might see what the world, you know, was like elsewhere and what potentially North Korea could be like. But actually, it sort of had the reverse impact.
Yeah, that is the conclusion that I draw. There was a lot of hope that because Kim Jong-un had spent such formative teenage years in Switzerland, you know, traveling in France and Italy and seeing, you know, what a open and democratic society looked like, that he would want some of that for his own country. I mean, similar expectations greeted Bashar al-Assad when he became the president of Syria as well, and they also proved wrong with him. But in Kim Jong-un's case, I think he realized during his time in Switzerland that if it wasn't for his, you know, family and the myth and the propaganda and this unique place that they hold in North Korea, he would be nobody. You know, he would not be special. He would just be another kid, you know, struggling with his homework, struggling to express himself, you know, not very good on the basketball court and, you know, not getting cheered for it all the same. So probably rather than convincing him that he should try to reform North Korea, I think that it convinced him he needed to keep North Korea exactly as it was, because if it was to open up, he would lose this privileged princeling status that he has.
And I suppose what's interesting as well, and you detail this in the book, is that when he was in Switzerland, it wasn't necessarily the case that he would ultimately come to power. He wasn't the first choice for heir to the throne.
No, I mean, he wasn't. He had an older half-brother who was more than 10 years older than him. And so by rights, you know, according to Korean hierarchies, he, Kim Jong-nam, should have been the successor. But in fact, Kim Jong-un was... he was the third son of Kim Jong-il, and he was settled on to be the successor to his father. And I think he rose to the top partly because he did display a natural aptitude for this kind of tyranny. But also, it's more, I think, because of their mothers. Kim Jong-nam's mother.
Battling mothers.
The battling mothers, exactly. And so Kim Jong-nam, the firstborn son, his mother basically had a mental breakdown, a nervous breakdown, when Kim Jong-nam was 3 years old because, you know, her partner, Kim Jong-il, had taken up with another woman. And so this mother went off to Moscow and she basically lived there for the rest of her life. So she had very little influence in Pyongyang and in the circles of power there. Whereas Kim Jong-un's mother was a very ambitious, calculating woman, and she really positioned her sons to be the successors to their father. So she made sure that they had the right connections and the right education. Both of her sons went to the, you know, premier military academy in Pyongyang. So I think that was really the decisive factor. You know, Kim Jong-un had a tiger mother, and that's what decided it.
And the pathways that these different brothers ended up on, I mean, pretty remarkable how differently life turned out. Kim Jong-nam, the half-brother who was assassinated, you reveal in the book that he had been working for the CIA.
Yes, that's right. So Kim Jong-nam went into a kind of quasi-exile in the early 2000s, and he had lived in Macau and China pretty much consistently that whole time. And he showed no interest really in having anything to do with the leadership of the regime. But he retained some ties to it and was probably getting money from the regime for those years until his younger brother became the leader. And he seems to have been cut off after that time. So he was publicly quite critical of his brother, which, you know, Kim Jong-un would consider treasonous. But it also emerged, I discovered during the course of my reporting, that he had become an informant for the CIA, and he would meet his American handlers in various locations in Southeast Asia from time to time and pass on what information he knew about the regime during that period. There also is a theory that perhaps the CIA, you know, which has a track record of trying to change regimes and install more favorable leaders, that perhaps the CIA was looking at Kim Jong-nam as a possible alternative to Kim Jong-un in North Korea. I mean, either way, it's more than ample reason for Kim Jong-un to want to try to get rid of his half-brother.
So he obviously sees threats around him. Is it just members of his family that he feels threatened by, or is it other members of the regime?
I mean, it's anybody. A dictator is by nature paranoid, you know, and expecting to be challenged at every turn. So there have been some family members like this older half-brother. And also, memorably, Kim Jong-un's own uncle, Jang Song-taek, who was a very mercurial character, had been a key player in the regime for decades, but also had his own power base and his own factions. Kim Jong-un had him hauled out of a Communist Party meeting in 2013, humiliated, and then executed a few days later. By the same token, he's had his propaganda chief, the head of the army, the defense minister, all of them have either been removed from power, they've just disappeared from view, or in one case, there were credible reports that one of them, the defense minister, was killed by anti-aircraft fire, which would have, you know, reduced him to a pulp. So that is Kim Jong-un's way of sending a very powerful message to anybody who might think about challenging him or questioning him, you know, think twice or you'll end up in a puddle on the ground like that poor old defense minister.
Given what you've revealed about the CIA effectively handling or running the brother, has there been any fallout from that that we know of?
Not so far, apart from the fact, I mean, this is not insignificant, that Donald Trump talked about it this week. He responded to these reports based on my book, saying that this would not have happened under his auspices, which seemed to suggest that he would not use members of the Kim family or members of the regime to gather intelligence on Kim Jong-un, which is just astounding because, you know, intelligence agents call North Korea the hardest of all the hard targets. You know, there is almost no human intelligence on North Korea. So the fact that the president of the United States would, you know, tell his buddy Kim, basically, that he wouldn't try to collect intelligence on him anymore is, you know, really quite shocking.
What do you think of this relationship between Trump and Kim? Because a lot of observers have been really very skeptical of the summits between the two of them. But it seems to me that in some ways you think Trump has been quite shrewd.
I don't know if Trump has been quite shrewd. I think Kim Jong-un has been quite shrewd in the way that he has figured out how to push all of Trump's buttons. So, you know, for example, all of these beautiful love letters that he's been sending, as Trump said this week, you know, he knows to flatter President Trump, to not just write a letter, but write a letter in a huge envelope and to praise him. And that's working. He hasn't had to give anything up or, you know, offer any substance. The style has been enough so far. But having said that, and the fact that, yeah, that they're not making any progress, even though both sides seem to want to be in talks, I think it's worth a chance, this very unconventional process that's going on right now, because like 30 years of America trying to convince North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons and, you know, become a respectable member of the international community just haven't worked, the old carrot and sticks approach. So maybe this very unconventional, you know, two leaders who are very different from their predecessors, maybe they can weirdly, you know, make some progress where it's been so elusive in the past.
And there is this incredible detail in your book about Kim sending out his advisors to try and find out everything they can about Trump, and a bunch of them reading The Art of the Deal, for example, to try and get a handle of them on the man that Kim was going to be meeting.
Yeah, that's right. The North Koreans have a huge advantage in these talks because they know so much about Donald Trump. Like, there's so many media interviews, you know, thousands of tweets that they can pore over, and they do. But also, you know, the lurid tales that come out, like these books like Fire and Fury about how Trump operates his White House. That all gives North Korea a lot of insight into how Trump operates and how to approach him. Whereas the U.S. side, they have relatively very little information about how Kim Jong-un operates, who are his advisors, you know, what are his interests and motivations here. And that's part of the reason why I wanted to write the book, because I wanted to bring together all of the information in the open source that could be collected about this most elusive leader.
I think the picture that develops in your book, though, is quite different to the image that we have had of Kim, this sort of young guy that landed in power, that was probably quite erratic, may not have the goods to run the country in the way that his father and grandfather did. But you actually paint him as being quite strategic in the way that he's retained control. But I wonder what you think his bigger picture strategy is.
Yeah. I mean, when he came in, he was only 27 years old. He had no experience, no qualifications, no credentials. And so that was why there was, you know, so little expectation about him, and why, you know, there was a tendency in the world to view him as a joke, like he looks like a cartoon character villain, right? So people would laugh at him. And so part of the reason I wanted to write about this is to show that he is no joke, that he is deadly serious. I mean, especially deadly for the people of North Korea, but that he has been very strategic and shrewd in the way he's approached the job of running a totalitarian dictatorship. So, I mean, his number one goal is staying in power, of keeping his family's privileged position and their decadent lifestyle and their security there in North Korea. So that is his guiding force every day when he wakes up. So the nuclear program had that in mind. The nuclear program was designed to show Kim Jong-un's strength domestically, to show the military, you know, that they could be strong under his leadership, to instill a sense of national pride in the general North Korean population, and also to show to the outside world, you know, to show to the Americans that they should think twice about striking North Korea, because North Korea had a credible nuclear response. So the nuclear part was the first part of his equation and the thing that he devoted his first years in power to. And now I think he is turning to economic development, because North Korea's economy is really, you know, so broken, so run down. There have been some improvements under him, but he needs to accelerate that if he's going to continue to tell the people of North Korea that, you know, life is getting better under him. And so that's what's motivating him now in this diplomatic process. He wants to get rid of those sanctions.
You've had, I think, 6 visits to North Korea. Has it changed much since this Kim has been in charge?
Yeah, 6 to Pyongyang, 12 and to North Korea as, in total. It has changed a lot. You know, when I first went to Pyongyang in 2005, it was very, very run down and seemed like on the brink of collapse, like economic collapse, if not regime collapse. And then when I went back the first time under Kim Jong-un in 2014, I was really shocked to see how much better the capital looked. And I mean, it is a showcase capital. It's supposed to be looking the best out of everywhere in the country, and is certainly not representative of how most North Koreans live. But even the fact that Kim Jong-un had managed to give this Potemkin capital an upgrade or makeover was quite surprising, because now, you know, there are these huge apartment towers in the middle of Pyongyang. There are German, beer halls and Italian restaurants. You know, you can do yoga classes and buy cappuccinos, and there are fake Gucci bags swinging from, you know, women's arms everywhere there. So for the elites, and especially like millennials, Kim Jong-un's generation in Pyongyang, who keep him in power, he's really made sure that life has gotten better for them and that their standard of living has improved a lot. And, you know, he wants them to support him for years or perhaps decades to come. And so that's why he's really focused on coddling this generation of elite millennials who will owe their loyalty to him.
Okay. Beer steins and yoga. Who would have thought? Anna Fifield, thank you very much.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Anna Fifield's new book is The Great Successor, The Divinely Perfect Destiny of Brilliant Comrade Kim.